Welcome to Mentioned in Dispatches, the podcast from the Western Front Association, with me, Dr. Tom Thorpe. The WFA is the UK's largest Great War History Society. We are dedicated to furthering understanding of the Great War and have around 50 branches worldwide. For more information, visit our website at westernfrontassociation.com. It is the 15th of March, 2025, and this is episode 351. Now, on today's podcast, I'm delighted to be joined by historian and author Steve R. Dunn. Steve's latest book, Spectre of Invasion, The Royal Navy and the Defence of Britain's Coast, 1900 to 1918, has just been released by Seaforth Publishing. The book explores Britain's deep-seated fears of invasion during the early 20th century, and the strategic debates between naval and military defence advocates and the reality of coastal raids and naval engagement during the First World War. Steve joins me from his home in Worcestershire. Steve, welcome to the podcast. Now, before we dive into your book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what drew you to research the naval history of the First World War, and especially as it relates to invasion?
Sure. I'm lucky enough to have two careers, first in business and now as a historian and an author. I've always had an interest in the history and arts and society of the sort of Edwardian era. But one day in a second-hand bookshop in Cambridge, I stumbled on Commander Geoffrey Bennett's Naval Battles of the First World War, read that and suddenly thought, here's a subject that really interests me, because it allowed me to focus on my interests in a specific context. And the great thing about the naval history of that period is you've got weapons which are recognisable today, modern weapons and modern vessels, but with 19th century decision taking. There was very few artificial aids to decision taking in those days. You have to think of Jellicoe standing on the bridge of Iron Duke at Jutland, having to decide by himself in which way he would deploy the fleet, without any outside input, or men like Rear Admiral Craddock accepting battle at Coronel, deciding by himself what it was that he could do. And aided only really by their conditioning, education, experience, training, but not by any outside stimulus. So I find the people aspect of it very, very fascinating. And I was fortunate enough to be taken up by the specialist naval publisher Seaforth. And 14 books later, here we are, with a 15th to come out in the autumn.
Yes, I have yet to start my publishing career, but I can understand how addictive it can be.
Indeed.
Now, your book examines the fear of invasion that gripped Britain in the early 20th century. What inspired you to explore this particular aspect of naval history?
Well, the whole question of the defence of Britain was very much a live issue around 1900. Indeed, it always had been, because as an island, the sea is either a friend or a foe. It's a route by which invasion can come, but it's also a defence against invasion. And it had been assumed for many years that the likely enemy was France, and invasion was a real threat, but the Navy would protect us because the sea around Britain facilitated the Navy doing that. There was much debate in Parliament and in public about the threat of invasion, but with the Entente Cordiale of 1904 and the settlement resolution of our differences with France, suddenly France wasn't the enemy and Germany was emerging as an enemy. And it was still assumed that the Navy was responsible for the defence of the island, a decision that was originally taken in the 18th century when it was called our strong and sure shield. But was it and could it? And I thought that was a good starting point for an analysis and eventually a book.
Now, you highlight how popular literature and the press fueled the public's anxiety about invasion. How significant was this influence in shaping actual government policy and military planning?
Massively so. As today, media drove the issue, but it was primarily newspapers and books in those days. And the issue was important to the media because it helped drive circulation and influence in Parliament. It started with literature. We have people like H.G. Wells, Arthur Conan Doyle, writing about invasion, and later authors such as Starkey, and even P.G. Woodhouse, who wrote a very good skit on invasion. And a literary genre grew up that was sort of on a par with the science fiction or young adult fiction of today. The seminal work was probably Lieutenant Colonel George Tomkins Chesney. In 1871, he published in Blackwood's magazine a story called The Battle of Dorking. Chesney believed that Britain was unprepared for an armed invasion from Germany, and especially after Germany's victory in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. And his intention was to awaken the nation to the fact that he thought there were a very meagre number of troops in the British Army, and the likelihood that Britain would be unable to defend herself if she was invaded. And then you had another masterwork in 1903, the publication of The Riddle of the Sands by Erskine Childers. And here, a sardonic Foreign Office civil servant, Carruthers by name, accepts an invitation from a college friend, a shyly intrepid yachtsman, to go on a sailing holiday in the Baltic. And there, amidst the fogs and the coastal creeks, they discover a German plot to invade England. But I think that the book that really made the invasion fear reach boiling point was William Le Queux, The Invasion of 1910. And in this bestseller, Le Queux imagines a successful invasion of England by a 40,000-strong German army, followed by such horrors as the Battle of Royston and the bombardment of London. And the story was all the more potent to the public because it was serialised in Lord Northcliffe's Daily Mail. Northcliffe was a keen advocate of increased military spending and of conscription, and he used the narratives to further his causes, those of pressurising the government, but also furthering the sales of his newspapers. And to the latter end, he had the author redraw the original route that Le Queux had written of the fictional German invasion, so it passed through towns with a large potential Daily Mail readership, and thus allowed the Hun to terrorise every major town in England from Sheffield down to Chelmsford, a very interesting route they must have taken. There was also a very considerable fear of German spies and of sleepers. There were lots and lots of German waiters and German hairdressers in Britain at the time. Britain was a reasonably high-wage economy compared to Germany, and it attracted a lot of the Germans into jobs like that. And newspapers and fiction writers took up that cause, saying that all these hairdressers and waiters and what have you were sleepers who would rise up and form the core of an invading army. And indeed, when war did break out, various newspapers advertised competitions to spot the spy, you know, report the spy to the authorities and we'll give you money. So Northcliffe and others drove the whole debate through the Times and the Daily Mail, both of which he owned, and exerted considerable pressure on government in doing so.
Now, the ways that people saw to counter an invasion were primarily by the Navy, obviously the Royal Navy, and the Army. Now, there's a major tension in your book is the, debate, conflict, argument between those who advocated for a strong Navy as the primary means of coastal defence and preventing invasion, and those who supported a larger standing army, and obviously notably arguments around conscription. So what were the main arguments on both sides, and how was this debate, if at all, ultimately resolved?
Well, I think in truth the debate was only resolved by the war, but it was strongly argued, especially by navalists, that the Navy could intercept and destroy any invading force, and therefore lots of money should be invested in the Navy. But the Army said the Navy couldn't be everywhere at once, and it should be defending the trade routes of empire, and therefore the Germans could sneak through. And the debate polarised and became one of whether or not the Navy could be relied on to defend the coast and prevent invasion, or was a larger army, possibly backed by conscription, necessary. Prime Minister Arthur Balfour tried to resolve this by something called the Balfour number. He asked the War Office for an estimate of the smallest invasion force it thought credible. And they replied that the Germans would need at least 70,000 men plus equipment. The Admiralty said they were confident they could detect an invasion force of 70,000 and interdict it and destroy it. And so on the 8th of July 1903, the Committee for Imperial Defence minuted that a restructuring of the army could be considered under the assumption that a naval invasion in force of the British Islands didn't have to be taken into account. And as the War Office had said, they need at least 70,000 people to successfully subdue the nation. The issue, according to Balfour, was that of dealing with smaller raiding forces of, say, 5,000 or 10,000 men. And it was on that basis that the army were told to plan. Certainly, that meant that the Navy were responsible for preventing invasion, and military provision to resist a major invasion would be a waste of money. And indeed, instead, a home defence force, primarily of militia and volunteers, should be strong enough to defeat raids of 5,000 to 10,000 men. And it was on this basis, really, that Haldane progressed with his army reforms of 1906 and created the territorial force. The prevailing belief in naval circles and amongst many politicians and the public was that the army was a projectile to be fired by the Navy, a small professional firefighting force to quell rebellions and the threat to empire. A large standing army was considered both expensive and unnecessary, both on grounds of cost and of usefulness. And it was also strongly opposed by organized labor and the political left, who feared that it could be used to coerce the proletariat. It was also believed that the Navy would follow the time-honoured tradition of close blockade of the enemy's ports. But the advent of the submarine, the mine and the torpedo really made the North Sea a very hostile place for expensive battleships. And around 1911-12, the decision was made to rely instead on distant blockade, with the North Sea bottled up and the main battle fleet in the far north, where it could intercept a German fleet trying to get out into the Atlantic. Right up to the war, it was perceived that the Navy was responsible for defence, and Britain's small army would be used as a firefighting force somewhere.
Many people associate the First World War, obviously, with the Western Front, mud, rats, Blackadder, etc. But your book details German naval raids on British coastal towns such as Scarborough, Great Yarmouth and Lowestoft. What impacts did these have? What impact did these attacks have on both military strategy and civilian morale?
Well, there were about 20 different attacks from the sea on 14 different sites, as far apart as Great Yarmouth and St Kilda. Scarborough was shelled twice, Great Yarmouth three times, and both towns, incidentally, were also attacked by Zeppelins. Civilians and children in arms were killed. And this led to accusations of murder, to a breach of the Hague Convention, and the press named the German admiral responsible for the attacks of 1914, Admiral Hipper, was named as the baby killer. Scarborough was considered at the time a heinous attack because it was an undefended port and thus protected by the Hague Convention at the time. Later, commentators have said that the Germans were justified in attacking the town because the castle had long been associated with coastal guns, but there weren't any, and it remains a moot point. Certainly, there was an impact of terrorizing the population, but by and large, the civilians bore these attacks stoically. There were calls for better defense and for revenge, but the leading citizens of, for example, Lowestoft and Hartlepool, each wrote to the Admiralty praising the attempts at coastal defence made by the naval forces on hand. The problem was that the fleet was in the north, so the coastal forces that were available were by and large much smaller vessels. A considerable investment had been made in Royal Garrison artillery and forts along the coast, a shore defence network, That was built at the turn of the century to placate those who were afraid of invasion. But it was spectacularly useless. Hardly fired in anger except at Hartlepool and didn't sink a single German ship.
And so your book looks at how the Royal Navy defended British shores during the conflict. How effective do you think the naval response was to these raids? And obviously, what challenges did they face in trying to counter them?
Well, there was certainly individual heroism shown by individual ships' crews. But by and large, the Navy's defence of the coast was hampered by the fact that the Grand Fleet was at Scapa Flow, far, far north. And this meant that reaction time for the fleet to get to, say, Great Yarmouth was much too long to intercept a tip-and-run raid. And indeed, John Jellicoe, the commander-in-chief of the Grand Fleet, eventually declared that the Grand Fleet would not try to prevent bombardment, but attempt to intercept the Germans as they returned home. And this was a mirror image of the German strategy, because they were out to attack undefended towns from the sea in an attempt to draw out and isolate and sink a portion of the Grand Fleet in order to whittle down the number of major units without having to have a stand-up sea battle. And in any case, there was simply not enough smaller craft to mount a credible defence everywhere, all of the time. Despite the fact that the auxiliary force, which I've written three books about, I find the auxiliary force fascinating, taking up 157 yachts and over 3,000 trawlers and drifters and many, many US-designed motorboats, they simply weren't enough because they were busy minesweeping and seeking out U-boats. And although their volunteer crews worked long and hard, they were no use against German fleet units. So in fact, because of the conditions of war that came about, the Grand Fleet said it wouldn't try and stop the bombardments, and the smaller ships were not capable of stopping the bombardments, so the whole strategy was turned on its head.
So, you suggest that the way that Britain struggled to coordinate its naval and military efforts to counter these was somewhat disjointed. What were the main weaknesses of Britain's coastal defence strategy, and could they realistically be avoided?
Well, I think the key thing to bear in mind is that the Navy didn't expect or plan to fight the sort of war which emerged. British war planning shifted from a reliance on naval force and a small army, a projectile to be fired by the Navy, to a continental commitment, conscription and a mass army. If we go back to 1900, Prime Minister at the time, Lord Salisbury, said to those in the War Office who were pushing for a larger army, "Our army will not find itself in that condition, i.e. fighting a major foe, in a blue moon. What they ought to practice is the rapid expedition of a relatively small force to any point in the empire where it might be wanted. Your business is that of a military fire brigade." And indeed, as recent writers like Professor Ian Beckett has noted that pre-war assumptions dictated that a future war would be short, and Britain would adopt a business-as-usual approach of a limited maritime commitment resting primarily on naval blockade. So the war that came about wasn't a war that anybody was expecting in terms of the way it was fought. Yet by 1914, we have Lord Kitchener calling for a million-man army. Many people have argued that this European commitment was a mistake and that the slaughter on the Western Front might have been avoided if we'd followed Admiral Fisher's Baltic strategy or Winston Churchill's Turkish War that had been properly persecuted and prosecuted, or Lloyd George's preference for attacking through the soft belly of Italy and Salonika. And many of more had believed that Germany could be defeated by the use of Britain's maritime power to impose a complete blockade on Germany, both physical and economic, which would bring her to her knees. But that required an amphibious army to secure choke points and offshore bases. And the Army General Staff absolutely refused to join in that debate. And the civilian leadership, the politicians, didn't challenge them. Professor Andrew Lambert has written that this was in part because the Anglo-French staff talks linked to the soldiers' preferred strategy of dispatching an army to France, helping to sustain the Anglo-French Entente of 1904, which in turn promised to preserve the peace. And When the decision was made to send Britain's army to France, it was Asquith, Prime Minister, Foreign Secretary Grey, War Minister Haldane, and Churchill, together with Kitchener, and no other cabinet member present, who met with nine army generals and just one admiral, Battenberg, the first Sea Lord. And they, the politicians, were unwilling to challenge the soldiers' declaration that Germany could only be beaten on land. And indeed, Churchill, who should have argued for the naval cause, was gung-ho for the commitment of the army. And everyone except Kitchener expected a short war, you know, over by Christmas. And the result was really the two armed services were separated and left fighting two different wars. The Navy found itself in a desperate battle to ensure that Britain was not starved into submission by the U-boats and the unrestricted war against merchant shipping. That created the need for the large auxiliary force, which I've already mentioned. And then once involved in a continental war, Britain had to double down because if Germany had triumphed, her borders would have been the English Channel and the Atlantic coasts. And at that point, invasion would have been both possible and probably likely. And Britain could in turn have been blockaded and defeated. A land war, however horrible it turned out to be, was therefore considered to be unavoidable. And the Navy's preferred strategy, which was economic and physical blockade, it was impossible without army support and the closure of the Baltic to impose a full blockade on German imports of critical supplies such as iron ore and ball bearings. Churchill and Asquith, key players at the beginning of the war at the Admiralty and as Prime Minister, wouldn't acquiesce to this for fear of offending the Scandinavian neutrals. And in fact, when Admiral Fisher was asked to put forward a proposal for doing this, Churchill prevented it, the paper being circulated at the War Council. So as a result, Britain really threw away her pre-war naval strategy and her source of advantage, and millions of young British men became casualties of the war. She also, inadvertently perhaps, handed the USA financial precedent, The United States had long been a debtor company, a country, but emerged from the war as a net creditor. And before the war, the centre of the world's capital markets was London, and the Bank of England was the world's most important financial institution. After the war, leadership had gone to New York, and the role of the Federal Reserve was much enhanced. And while we're on the subject of the US, it's worth mentioning that the fear of invasion wasn't just confined to Britain. There were those in America who feared invasion as well. In 1914, the United States thought it was protected by 3,000 miles of water off its east coast and 5,000 miles off its west coast. But those oceans were mainly controlled by Britain. The United States Navy was very small. And so the United States could afford to be ignorant on the global stage without great consequences. But the war changed that. Under the headline, The United States, an Undefended Treasure Land, the Scientific American magazine editorialized that today war falls like a thunderbolt from heaven, and the first is often the decisive blow. The days of small standing armies, of slow preparation, and still slower transportation have passed. And they went on to write, the possible enemies of today are fully prepared. They control almost unlimited transport, and once in possession of sea control, can land where they wish. And indeed, in 1916, a group of suffragists in Maine, led by a lady called Lurana Sheldon Ferris, formed the Women's Defence Club to instruct women to shoot and defend themselves and their families from German attack. And the New York Times reported that they would not be as helpless as Belgian women, and rather than wait to be raped or killed by madmen, she and her colleagues were prepared to kill if necessary. And in 1915, the US War Department actually estimated and published that Germany, if not interfered with, could land 337,000 men in America in 16 days and 440,000 men in 31 days. Quite where these men were coming from, I'm not sure. There was, of course, a vested interest in such claims because a standing army had never been popular in the USA, as in Britain. But a preparedness movement was afoot, led by ex-President Theodore Roosevelt and by former Chief of Staff Leonard Wood. And they exploited the fact that many in the US were concerned that their boundaries were both long and open to start the process of militarization in America. So it's quite interesting that you know, Britain, you next to Germany, separated by the Channel, was fearful of invasion, but so was America, 3,000 miles away.
Yes, I remember Red Dawn in the 1980s, which was a film about American high school kids taking on Russian parachutists as they invade America. So the fear is not gone in many ways.
No.
So your work is very rich with first-hand accounts. Could you share a particular story that illustrates the fear, bravery or decision-making during these days when the coastal defences were fearing invasion?
Right, there are many stories in the book. I'll mention just two different ones. In 1916, Commodore Tyrwhitt took the Harwich force of light cruisers and destroyers to try and fend off an attack on Great Yarmouth and Lowestoft by major German battle fleet units. And watching this from the shore was a fish merchant called Alfred Turner, and he wrote to a friend, "Very heavy firing recommenced at sea, and we knew there was a fight, so we all went up and saw our little torpedo boat destroyers steaming north to meet the Hun dreadnoughts. They passed in front of our house, and a very few minutes afterwards, the leader stopped, and the whole line steamed round him, each boat firing a broadside as she turned at the Germans. It was magnificent, but it was not war. It was the case of a wasp stinging a tiger." And then he went on to say, "It was suicide to attack the enemy, but in doing so, they drew fire from the town, and the Huns fired their 12-inch guns at them that failed to hit them except once that I saw. The columns of water were going up where the shells went into the sea, exactly like high church steeples all round our boats. There were 19 of the little things, and it all happened about 4 or 5 miles from the beach. I would not have missed seeing it for £50. And then, perhaps more piteously, in Hartlepool in 1914, we see the human cost. A man called George Jobling's house was hit by German shellfire, knocking him across the room. And when he recovered, he told the coroner, "I went round to the door and found 3 children among a lot of bricks, 2 of them being my son's children. They had been killed by a shell which struck my house." His son was a stoker in the Royal Navy away on duty.
So beyond the immediate defence of the coastline, what were the broader strategic and political implications of these invasion fears for Britain's war effort?
Well, one of the key ones was that men were retained in Britain who could have been used on the Western Front. Politicians, and especially Lloyd George, were reluctant to send them out. A, because he thought the army would use them wastefully, but B, because he believed they needed to be kept in Britain defend the coast. So there was something like 175,000 trained soldiers kept back in Britain when they'd been requested for the Western Front in spring 1918. And that was a precaution against attempted invasion and also against internal unrest, so crystallising the fears of the working class movements that unrest might be suppressed by the army. In total, in January 1918, there were 1.5 million soldiers in Britain, including those wounded or under training. So that was a very considerable commitment of men being retained in Britain who could have been used on other fronts.
And finally, I suppose the dreaded question that many historians have to answer is about lessons for today. What do you think modern military and strategic planners can learn from Britain's approach to coastal defence in the First World War? Are there any sort of parallels with contemporary concerns over maritime security?
I think there are. But I think the first point we have to make is that we hardly have a navy today. And much of what we have is laid up for maintenance or repair. If a determined enemy did decide to come and attack our coasts, we've not got much to fight them with. But I don't think you actually need I don't think an enemy actually needs to come and fight our navy, because our connections to the outside world, by freight, by electricity interconnects, by data cables, are all desperately exposed and open to disablement, as is being demonstrated currently by Russia's activities in the Baltic when they keep cutting the data cables. Any malefactor really has only to disrupt these nodes, to mine the channel, to stop our supplies getting through, and the country would be helpless. You know, we don't have food security. We don't grow anything like enough of our own food. We rely on obtaining a lot of our electricity from abroad at the moment. And successive governments, but especially the current one, it seems, continue to ignore these facts. Our food security is currently something that's very current because the attacks on the farming community by this malevolent government put that at even more risk than it currently is. And if you were to draw a navalist conclusion from all of this, you might argue that we don't need large aircraft carriers. We desperately need light craft for coastal defence and drones for minesweeping and the like to protect these important assets. And I think unlike the 1900s, at least in the 1900s, people were aware that there was a problem and they were trying to organise a strategy to do something about it. We seem not to be able to recognise that we live in a troubled world and defence spending is not optional, it's essential. Then the debate was how to defend our shores, not if. Now it's the ostrich strategy. Ignore it and it will go away. But I don't think it will.
On that note of caution and rather dark finish, Stephen, thank you very much for your time.
You have been listening to the Mentioned in Dispatches podcast from the Western Front Association with me, Tom Thorpe. Thank you for all my guests for appearing on this edition. The theme music for this podcast was George Butterworth's The Banks of Green Willow. It was performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, conducted by Krish Russman, and produced by Biz Records. This recording is part of a collection of orchestral works by Butterworth performed by the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and supported by the Western Front Association. This is available from all good record stores under the record code BIS21. 95. Until next time.